Hi, Patrick Cox here with The World in Words. If I were in the glorious Democratic People's Republic of Korea, I might greet you this way. But I'm in Boston. I don't speak Korean. I can't sing. And last but not least, I'm not a woman. I'm a man, baby. So let's do this instead. I may not be a female Korean singer, but this podcast will focus on the Korean language. This week, I can promise you the best Inside North Korea report you've ever heard. It'll make you laugh, it'll make you cry. Also, the Korean language as it is spoken north and south of the border. Plus, weirdly and totally out of context, the Hungarian word for peach and its White House connection.
As a free man, I take pride in the word Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
My name is Matthew Fitt, I'm from Dundee, I'm a writer, but I didn't bide in Dundee anymore, I bide in a toon card bigger than the south of Scotland.
This podcast comes to you from public radio programme The World, otherwise known as The Big Show, is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International and WGBH. If you haven't heard it, check it out. On your radio, even. It's the only public radio show 100% dedicated to international news and culture. It's produced here in sunny Boston by a crack team of journalists. No, maybe a better way of putting it is the show is produced by a group of people who love foreign stuff. And over the years, they've developed some skills. So you can hear The Big Show Monday through Friday on your local public radio station or online at theworld.org or on iTunes. The podcast is called Latest Edition, and on iTunes, it's in the PRI folder. And on the subject of iTunes, if that's the way you listen to this podcast, please consider writing a review of this podcast. Just a sentence or two will do. I think it really helps in getting other people interested and clicking on it and listening for the first time. I've only asked people to do this once before. It was about 6 months ago. I got a great response. We got a bunch of really great reviews. And I think that that really helped establish this podcast. And the point of my asking this is we all want to keep the podcast going. It's completely free. If people download the podcast, my bosses are happy. They get the word out about The Big Show and all the other podcasts and the radio shows the PRI puts out. So if you can write reviews, if you can tell your friends, tell your blogger friends, tell your Facebook friends, join the Facebook group, The World in Words, all of that's going to help enormously. Not only that, I will thank you in many, many different languages. Really, I will happily make a complete fool of myself mispronouncing thank you in several dozen languages. Oh, God. Today, we're doing Korean, north and south of the DMZ. We'll be running a report, a really eye-opening report from inside North Korea. This includes an unforgettable song, as well as many other sad and creepy moments. We'll also hear just how different Korean is when it's spoken in the north as opposed to in the south. And these are not your usual linguistic differences, dialect, regional differences that you get in many other parts of the world. These are differences that reflect the huge political and economic gulf between North Korea and South Korea. We'll also hear from a North Korean defector now living in Seoul who has completely erased his northern accent so he can get ahead in the South. We'll round off today's podcast with Eating Sideways and an exchange that Barack Obama had in Europe in which he learns a little bit of Hungarian. So, Korean. North Korea, South Korea, they're divided by many things. The demilitarized zone, the DMZ, ideology, bitterness, wildly different economies, and by language, the common language that they use very differently. The Korean Peninsula is in the news right now. Yesterday, I'm recording this on April 10th, yesterday the North Korean parliament, surprise, surprise, unanimously appointed Kim Jong-il to his third term as president. This comes less than a week after North Korea tried and failed to launch a rocket into orbit, or maybe they didn't fail, because the rocket launch, criticized by the U.S., by South Korea and Japan as a provocation, maybe there was a different intent there with the rocket launch. This was the scene yesterday in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, when Kim Jong-il, the dear leader, entered parliament, or as it's called there, the Supreme People's Assembly. What you're hearing is all 687 parliamentarians applauding as one. The dear leader, by the way, looked thin, he looked old, he looked spent. He's had a lot of health problems, but it's not clear how sick he may be. North Korea is not the kind of place where the doctor who gives the president his physical does a news conference. Here's a bit of North Korean TV news reporting on the parliamentary vote. Bad audio quality, I'm afraid.
미주의 강성대구 건설 위협 실현에서 위대한 전환적 국면이 열리고 있는 격동적인 시기에 소집된.
So the announcer here is, I don't understand a word of Korean, although I've seen a translation to what she's saying, and she's just talking about the vote in parliament, but doesn't she sound really over the top and heroic? It's always like that on North Korean TV. It's a style. Over the years, I've actually seen quite a bit of it. I recommend watching a bit of North Korean TV. It's funny because in South Korea, North Korean TV is banned. You're not allowed to watch it. Although there are a couple of places where they're allowed by the government to watch it, which is what I did. I went to a newspaper that monitored North Korean TV. And I asked the people there what they thought of the kind of Korean that they were hearing and the delivery and everything. And they just said it was just really old-fashioned and bizarre. And it seemed to creep them out a little bit. Certainly South Koreans don't talk that way at all. But remember, North Korea is referred to as the Hermit Kingdom for a reason. So now we have a really extraordinary story out of that hermit kingdom. This isn't specifically on the Korean language, though there are some moments where you hear some of it. Listen especially for the amazing verbless song sung in a restaurant by an 11-year-old boy. The song's words are very much rooted in the North Korean experience. The story is reported by TV producer Ann Kim. She didn't want to talk about, the usual stuff when it comes to North Korea, the personality cult of the dear leader, and of his father before him, the great leader, Kim Il-sung. Now, Anne wanted to focus on the stuff we know very little about, the country's people. But as you'll hear, the story is also about Anne's own mother, who has complicated feelings about North Korea. Here goes.
Pyongyang is my Uncle Ed's hometown. During the Korean War in the 1950s, he and his father fled from the North Korean army and headed south. My uncle was 16. In 1981, long after he had settled in the U.S., Uncle Ed received permission from the North Korean government to see his mother and siblings. So since then, he's been one of the lucky few able to make regular trips. This was the first time that he brought my mother and me. Growing up in a middle-class suburb of Los Angeles, I always thought of North Korea as a monster. Now in my head, I picture what I'd seen on the news: starving people, wilted crops, and automatons who love the dear leader. But what would they think of us? Our North Korean family hadn't been allowed to meet us at the airport. That reunion would come later. Instead, we were met by our smiling guides and a musical greeting. Over the course of our visit, we would get to know this song. It's how North Koreans welcome all their guests. "So great to meet you," she sings. "My fellow Koreans, brothers and sisters, meeting like this is so wonderful and happy." In the karaoke version, which I highly recommend, concert footage of a North Korean pop band is intercut with news footage of North Koreans welcoming South Korean guests, hugging, crying, and laughing. It's a song about the hopes of the entire Korean peninsula, that one day, North and South will become one. Always present to remind us of that were our two guides/minders, Comrade Cho and Comrade Park. I'd imagine they'd be like secret agents who'd arrest us if we said the wrong thing. I didn't expect them to be so nice. Their warmth really put Mom at ease. So did the unexpectedly green and lush rice fields.
"The landscape of this country is just beautiful, beautiful, and reminds me of late 1950s of South Korea where I grew up. It gave me the sense of really comfort, just seeing the whole scene of a country."
North Korea had hit a soft spot in Mom. Here was a country that she was taught to despise, a country she had never been to, an unlikely place to relive her childhood. By special request, Mom and I visited Korea Movie Studios, one of the favorite haunts of the great leader and his son, the dear leader. Our movie studio guide waved her hand with reverence over a small-scale model of the studio grounds. She clicked on a switch, lighting up some of the buildings. "The lighted buildings," she said solemnly, "indicate where the great leader and his son visited. Our great leader came here 30 times, The general has visited 300 times, his mother 9 times. One of the great leader's favorite places was a sound effects studio, so our guide told us. On October 8, 1964, the great leader had personally listened to the sound of horse clappers. Those clappers are now encased in glass. Our guide recreated what the great leader would have heard using some other pair of clappers. Outside, we visited some of the sets. North Korean filmmakers can't go anywhere, so they construct the outside world here. Our guide pointed to a house, which he said they use for movies set in Europe, anywhere in Europe. The house was meant to look majestic, but in reality it looked like a place where Cinderella might live if she were middle class. Mom walked over to another set.
This is the late 50s, early 60s South Korea Seoul.
This was the South Korean capital as North Koreans saw it. There was one bar after another, cigarette stalls, shoe stores, hair salons. If you wanted to be a gluttonous capitalist, Seoul was the place to be. We stared at billboards of loose South Korean women drinking martinis. We were all laughing, me, my mom, the guides. But then I thought, were we laughing at the same thing, or were the guides laughing at us? I remembered a conversation I'd had with our driver in Pyongyang. He said, "In the U.S., isn't money all that people care about? You start to care about money, not each other." I couldn't disagree with him. Back in our hotel room, I asked Mom what she thought of the trip so far.
For me, I felt very, very comfortable. I don't feel like I'm in a place where I could be totally stranger. If I have a car to get around here and I don't want to be out here, leave 6 or 7 whatever month and go back to state.
You would stay here for a long period of time?
Oh, I think I could. I have no fear.
No fear of what?
No fear of being here.
In Mom's eyes, we were all the same Korean people who just happened, by accident of history, to end up living in different places. In this country where I was at once a foreigner and a fellow countryman, Mom wanted me to feel rooted too. In order to meet Uncle's relatives, we had to submit a formal request to the government. We couldn't call Uncle's brother directly because he, like most North Koreans, doesn't own a phone. Instead, the government orchestrated our meeting. Personal spaces were off limits, so our hotel lobby became the living room and the hotel restaurant the dining room. Only 7 of Uncle's relatives were allowed to visit with us. Uncle's family looked out of place at the fancy restaurant. Seated to Uncle's right was his younger brother. I could see the similarity in the square faces of the two men, the slight cleft in the chin and thick heads of gray hair. But their bodies also revealed the disparity in their fates. Uncle's brother was too young to be drafted, so he stayed in North Korea. 53 years later, he sat next to Uncle, his back hunched, his frame shriveled. The youngest relative was a tiny 11-year-old. Sungil's shirt was soiled, but tucked in neatly. Before dinner, he stood up and sang a song for us. The song was all about food. No verbs, just nouns. Fried eggs, dried mushrooms, grandfather's favorite pickled herring. I wanted so badly to ask personal questions. Did they have enough to eat? What was their home like? And what did they really think of Kim Jong-il? But it was too risky to ask within earshot of so many strangers. And really, those details didn't matter, because the overall story was obvious, that we were the haves and they were the have-nots. Meeting Uncle's relatives, I realized how easily that could have been me on the other side of the table. I could have been the one collecting empty water bottles left over from the dinner, or wearing a pin every day with Kim Il-sung's face on it. Instead, at that moment, all I could do was run up to our room to find things to give away, like my playing cards and some hotel toiletries. As the little boy frantically rummaged through the bag I gave him, his grandmother remarked that these were really nice gifts. Mom was in a pensive mood after dinner. I asked her how she was feeling.
I don't know, I just feel so sad. Just by looking at them, I just want to feed them. It seems like that's the only I can do for right now. Just, you know, how you want to make them feel full. Just so sad.
On Sunday, it was time for church. My aunt and uncle went to the Protestant service, while Mom and I went to Mass. We arrived 15 minutes early, and we were surprised to see the rest of the congregation already seated and singing. A portrait of Jesus, one of the few white men I saw in Pyongyang, looked down from the altar. Sitting among fellow Catholics, Mom prayed with her rosary beads. After 45 minutes of song and prayer, we were escorted out. Everyone else stayed inside. Mom was stone-faced in the car ride back. In the lobby of the hotel, with our guides looming 15 feet away, Mom and my aunt shared stories of their church visits. Mom said that after the final blessing, the man who was in charge told us to leave because they were starting Bible study. She was upset that she couldn't stay, that she didn't even get to talk to one person. Then my aunt said something that poured salt into the wound. She had heard that someone from the Protestant service she'd gone to had been forced to show up. Were these church services real or not? Either way, Mom's love affair with Pyongyang was over. She had believed in North Korea, but now the government had tried to sell her the worst kind of lie. On the morning of our departure, Mom got a call from one of our guides. Comrade Park needed to search through my tapes. We felt frightened and betrayed. We had come to think of our guides as friends, but they were first and foremost officials of the state. Comrade Park listened to several of my recordings. In the end, Mom and I were cleared. We drove to the airport. Our flight was one of two leaving from Pyongyang that day. Like our arrival, our departure was marked by music. In Korean, there's a phrase for goodbye, but in North Korea, they prefer to say and sing, "We'll meet again." From their side, all you can say is "We'll meet again," never knowing if it will come true. In my Uncle Ed's case, he will likely see his relatives again. These visits are their lifeblood, but he knows that he cannot finance their life forever. As we waited to clear immigration, I turned around to see a crowd of North Korean officials, some of whom had been assigned to see us off. I spotted Comrade Park, the very person who hours before had been searching my tapes. She was crying. Mom was crying too. It seemed that Mom was crying for a lot of reasons. Because Comrade Park was a friend. Because she was also a government official. Because Mom went to a Catholic service. Because that service may have been fake. Because she got to meet her brother-in-law's family. Because that family was starving. Because she loved being on the Korean Peninsula. Because she couldn't wait to leave. Nothing made sense, except to cry. For the world, this is Ann Kim.
Ann Kim is a Boston-based TV producer. That was her first ever attempt at an audio story. Really amazing. So now, a little bit more on the two languages of the two Koreas, or rather, one language that has been divided as a result of war and politics. For thousands of North Korean refugees who now live in the South, it means that they have to get used to a dialect that sounds almost foreign. Here's a report from Seoul from Jason Strother.
Choi Soo-jong fled North Korea in 2001. Like many of the other 15,000 North Koreans who have defected to the South, Choi says at first she was blown away by all the cars and big-screen TVs she saw. She was perplexed by bank ATMs. Choi says she got used to those things pretty quickly, but she wasn't prepared to hit a language barrier while speaking with other Koreans.
I didn't realize how different the North and South Korean languages were until I started working for a recycling company. Back in North Korea, they only have one word to describe all kinds of paper, but here there are many. It really embarrassed me that I didn't know what my coworkers were talking about.
The North Korean language, like much of the nation itself, is stuck in a time warp. It's retained a lot of words and expressions that South Koreans no longer use, or the meanings have changed. For example, North Koreans still call a boxed lunch bento, which was used all over the Korean Peninsula in the early 20th century. It's now called tosherak in the South. Or the saying, ilop sumnida, In North Korea, it's a common response when asked, "How are you today?" meaning, "Fine, nothing special." But in South Korea, depending on who you're talking to, the phrase is considered to be quite rude, meaning something like, "Buzz off." For refugees, language is one of the toughest parts of adjusting to life in South Korea. That's according to Ko Kyung-bin, director of Hanawon, a government-run facility that gives newly arrived defectors a crash course on living in the capitalist world. "We try to teach them the new terminology through textbooks," Ko says. "We also encourage them to watch South Korean movies to learn how we speak." He adds that Hanawon even hires defectors who've lived in South Korea for a while to help translate. Regional dialects exist throughout Korea, but the North-South language divide has little to do with geographical differences. Like many other aspects of North Korean life, language has been manipulated to praise the country's rulers. Kim So-kyung lectures at the Ewha Institute for Unification Studies and has written a book on how North Koreans use their language. She gives an example of one word whose meaning has changed since the Koreas were divided. It's sunmul, and it translates as a gift or present one gives to a friend.
North Korean way of speaking this sunmul. Sunmul is the deserved reward by Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. So only Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il are only two who can give sunmul to another person.
Adding to refugees' linguistic difficulties is the infusion of English words into South Korean. The mix is known here as Konglish. These are especially prevalent in the names of relatively modern technology. You can't really expect someone to know how to send a fax or make a Xerox when they've never heard these words or even seen the devices themselves. Defector Choi Soo-jung says it was tough learning all these new words.
I had no idea what camera meant. In North Korea, it's called a sajinji. Now that I'm learning English, life is a little easier here. But before, I couldn't follow what my professors or classmates were saying because they used so many English words.
The Pyongyang regime not only keeps English words out, but has also done away with Chinese characters, which are still learned in South Korea. North Koreans believe they speak a superior form of the language, something many still believe even after they defect. Again, Kim So-kyung.
North Korean defectors are arguing their way of using Korean language as pure and clean way of protecting Korean from outside dirty thing.
Those dirty things, of course, mean foreign words. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
Now, the big show's Matthew Bell visited the resettlement center that Jason mentioned in his piece. That was just over a year ago. And you talked to people who went through the program. What was it about the language aspect of the program that they found most valuable?
Interestingly, a lot of folks told me they just wanted to study English. And when I visited the center there, the guy that was the director said people would arrive and very quickly start asking about English lessons because they thought that's the ticket to employment. But they might have started with some of that at the resettlement center, but it was actually Korean language was a big part of it. And here's an example. I've got some tape to play of a guy that explained to me how actually studying Korean, and that is the South Korean dialect, was extremely helpful for him in moving to Seoul. And this is a 20-something-year-old guy. He didn't want me to use his name because he's got family still back in North Korea. But here he is, and then you'll hear the translator come in and explain this example of what was useful in terms of studying the South Korean language.
Just Korean and English mixed words, not English. In North Korea, we literally translate all foreign words into Korean. So here I learn words like that are not in local Korean, like pen and taxi terms like that. And for example, when you go to a Korean restaurant, there is a term that says 물은 셀프입니다, which means water is self-serving. You have to serve yourself. 물은 셀프. But North Korean people would not understand that term. And they would ask, how much is 물은 셀프? Stuff like that is very important to know.
So as you hear from the example there, there's lots of English words that are used in South Korea that North Koreans would not be exposed to. So there's an example of sort of learning those words and learning how to feel less foolish, I think, in the South. Patrick, the one thing about that translator, after that interview, we walked out of there, and I don't speak Korean, so I couldn't really judge what this particular refugee's accent sounded like. But my translator said, wow, that guy speaks with no accent at all. And my understanding is that when North Koreans basically open their mouths, South Koreans pretty quickly know that they're from the North because of their accent. Now, my translator was just really impressed with this particular guy's way of speaking kind of South Korean Korean. And this refugee in particular was a really impressive guy in general. He told me another language-related story about how he had applied for jobs in South Korea, dozens of jobs, and put down that he was from the North. He didn't get a single call back, which he come to find out was because he's from the North, because later on he took that off the resume, applied for very similar jobs, and he got lots and lots of calls back. And he said the reason why, the big sort of selling point on his resume, was that he speaks Chinese fluently from several years of living in China. He went across the border from North Korea, lived in China, and actually worked there as some kind of a merchant. He said he was selling antiques or some kind of goods. But that was a real selling point in the South because so many companies want to get involved in the big emerging market in China.
So did you get to practice your Chinese on some of these North Koreans that you interviewed?
I did, and that was fun. I have to say my Chinese is not great, and it was rusty. It was fun to practice with them a little bit, but I wasn't good enough to do real interviews. Here's an example, another piece of tape of me speaking a little Chinese with a North Korean refugee, a teenager, 17 years old, who was at a school, special school for North Korean refugees, where I went up and did some reporting there.
你的中文比我的好得多。我在中国六年。
So basically there you hear me saying, I was trying to compliment that kid and say that, hey, your Chinese is much better than mine, and in fact it was. And then he started to explain a little bit about how he had lived in China for 6 years, I think he was saying, and how he really wants to study English, but in fact his Chinese is much better than his English. So as we heard from the other refugee, maybe that will help him too as he proceeds and goes through school and starts to apply for jobs in South Korea.
The Big Show's Matthew Bell. Matthew puts out his own podcast on U.S. foreign policy. It's called American Influence. Right now he's preparing an episode on the Obama administration's North Korea policy post-missile launch. The most recent episode already available is a very nice one on the debate inside and outside the Pentagon on whether the U.S. military should prepare itself better for counterinsurgency wars like the ones in Iraq and Afghanistan. For more details, go to theworld.org/podcasts. Before we go, we're going to eat sideways in Hungarian. Eating sideways is the bit in the podcast where I pick a foreign word or phrase that doesn't translate easily into English. Thank you, by the way, to everyone who's submitted their own suggestions. I've got quite a list of them, and I promise I will get to them. Please keep them coming. So the Hungarian expression is, and please excuse me, Hungarian speakers, ethem meg o szívedet, ethem meg o szívedet. And it means, literally, I like to eat your heart. Nice. But actually, it is nice. It is, believe it or not, used affectionately, often to small children. You say it to someone who's just displayed an act of generosity or selflessness. See what I mean? I like to eat your heart. And on the subject of Hungarian, just in case you missed it, Barack Obama learned a new Hungarian word on his recent European tour. Well, maybe his first Hungarian word. This was a scene at one of those town hall meetings that he likes to do.
Hi, I'm Ines, also from Heidelberg. And
hello.
And first of all, I wanted to tell you that your name in Hungarian means peach, if you knew.
Peach?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, how about that? I did not know that.
Yeah. Now you know it.
Now he indeed does know it. Just for the record, the word for peach in Hungarian is not Obama. It is Barack. Well, there appear to be many words for peach, as far as I can make out. Sometimes they're quite long words, and Barack is often a part of those words. It made me think, why are there so many Hungarian words for peach? I mean, this is a fruit that I can't even imagine it's even grown in Hungary. Please, someone, put me right. Post something on the Facebook group, The World in Words, or write me. The address is language@pri.org. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoyed spending all of that time in the company of Korean. You're listening right now to music recorded at a restaurant in Seoul. This is a very special place. It is a North Korean-themed restaurant where the food is Northern style and the people who work there are North Korean refugees. In fact, these refugees split their time between serving food and drink to the patrons and performing on stage. See you next week.